particular case. Husky wanted Patrick's case, for now. While eating a tomato sandwich in the kitchen alone, Lance saw something move in the rear yard, near the pool. He grabbed his shotgun, eased from the house, around some shrubs on the patio, and spotted a chubby photographer squatting by the pool house, three bulking cameras dangling from his neck. Lance tiptoed, barefoot, around the pool house, gun at the ready, and crouched to within 2 feet of the man's back. He leaned forward, placed the gun near the man's head with the barrel pointed upward, and pulled the trigger. The photographer lurched forward and fell on his face, screaming frightfully and floundering on top of his cameras. Lance kicked him between the legs, then again as he rolled over and finally got a glimpse of his assailant. Lance ripped off the three cameras and threw them into the pool. Trudy was on the patio, horrified. Lance yelled at her to call the police. Chapter 9. I'm going to scrape the dead skin away now, the doctor said, gently probing a chest wound with a pointed instrument. I really think you should consider some pain medication. No thanks, Patrick said. He was sitting on his bed, naked, with the doctor, two nurses, and the Puerto Rican orderly, Luis, huddled around him. It's gonna hurt, Patrick, said the doctor. I've been through worse. Besides, where would you stick me? He asked, lifting his left arm. It was covered with purple and dark blue bruises where the Brazilian doctor had relentlessly poked him during his ordeal. His entire body was a rainbow of bruises and scar tissue. No more drugs, he said. Okay, as you wish. Patrick reclined and gripped the side rails to his bed. The nurses and Luis held his ankles as the doctor began scraping the raw third-degree burns on his chest. With surgical scalpels, he pulled the dead skin off the wound, then cut it free. Patrick flinched and closed his eyes. How about a shot, Patrick? Asked the doctor. No, he grunted. More scalpels, more dead skin. These are healing nicely, Patrick. I tend to think you might not need skin grafts after all. Good, he said, then flinched again. 4 of the 9 burns were severe enough to be considered third degree, 2 on the chest, 1 on the left thigh, and 1 on the right calf. The rope burns on his wrists, elbows, and ankles were raw and covered with ointments. The doctor finished in half an hour and explained that it would be best to remain still, unclothed and unbandaged, at least for now. He applied a cool antibacterial salve and again offered pills for the pain. Patrick again declined. The doctor and the nurses left, and Luis loitered long enough to see them off. He closed the door behind them and pulled down the blinds. From a pocket under his white orderly's jacket, he produced a disposable Kodak camera with a flash. Start there, Patrick said, pointing to the foot of the bed. Get the entire body, including my face. Luis stuck the camera to his head, fiddled with it, back to the wall, then pushed the button. The camera flashed. Again from there, Patrick directed. Luis did as he was told. At first he'd been reluctant to agree to this venture, said his boss might need to approve it. Living on the border of Paraguay, Patrick not only had perfected his Portuguese, but he'd also learned to handle Spanish. He could understand almost everything Luis said. Luis had more trouble understanding Patrick. The language of money prevailed, with Luis eventually comprehending the offer of $500 in return for his services as a photographer. He agreed to purchase 3 disposable cameras, take almost 100 shots, get them developed overnight, and to hide them far from the hospital until further orders. Patrick didn't have $500 on him, but he persuaded Luis that he was an honest man, regardless of what he might have heard, and that he would send the money as soon as he got home. Luis wasn't much of a photographer, but then he didn't have much of a camera. Patrick coordinated every shot. There were close-ups of the serious burns on his chest and thigh, close-ups of his badly bruised limbs, full-length shots from every angle. They worked fast so they wouldn't get caught, It was almost time for lunch and another round of busy nurses with charts and incessant chatter. Luis left the hospital on his lunch break and dropped the film off at a camera shop. In Rio, Osmar convinced a low-paid secretary at Eva's law firm to accept $1,000 in cash in exchange for all the current in-house gossip. There wasn't much. Things were very quiet among the partners. But the phone records revealed two calls to the firm from a number in Zurich. It was a hotel, Guy determined, from Washington, but no other information was available. The Swiss were so discreet. Her partners had no patience with her disappearance. Their quiet gossip about her soon changed to daily meetings about what to do. She'd called once the first day, once the second, then no word. The mysterious client she had flown off to see could not be verified. Meanwhile, her legitimate clients were making demands and threats. She missed appointments, meetings, deadlines. Finally, they decided to temporarily remove her from the firm and deal with her later when she returned. Osmar and his men stalked Eva's father until the poor man was unable to sleep. They watched his apartment lobby and followed him in traffic and along the busy sidewalks of Ipanema. There was talk of snatching him and roughing him up a bit, forcing him to talk, but he was careful and never allowed himself to be isolated. On his third trip to her bedroom, Lance finally found the door unlocked. He entered quietly with another Valium and her favorite bottled sparkling water from Ireland, $4 a bottle, and he sat next to her on the bed without a word and held out the pill. She took it, her second in an hour, and she sipped the water. The police car carrying the chubby photographer had left an hour ago. Two cops hung around for 20 minutes asking their questions, apparently not anxious to press charges since it was private property and the press had been told to stay away. The publication was a sleazy magazine from up north anyway. The cops seemed quite sympathetic, even respectful of the way Lance handled the situation. They were given the name of Trudy's attorney downtown in case charges were to be pressed. Lance threatened to press charges of his own if hauled into court. Trudy snapped after the cops left. She threw cushions from a sofa into the fireplace as the nanny raced off with the child. She yelled obscenities at Lance because he was the nearest target. It was just too much. The news about Patrick, the lawsuit by the insurance company, the restraining order, the horde of vultures out front, and then Lance had caught a photographer by the pool. But she was quiet now. He'd had a Valium, too, and he sighed relief that she was under control. He wanted to touch her, to pat her on the knee and say something nice. But such gestures never worked on her in these situations. A wrong move and she would snap again. Trudy would cool down, but only on her own terms. Trudy reclined on the bed, closed her eyes, placed the back of her wrist on her forehead. The room was dark, like the rest of the house, blinds and shades pulled tight, lights off or dimmed. There were 100 people loitering out by the road, taking pictures and shooting film, to be used with all those wretched Patrick stories. At noon, she'd seen her house on the local news, in the background as some silly, orange-faced woman with large teeth gushed on about Patrick this and Patrick that, and a divorce filed by Patrick's wife that very morning. Patrick's wife! The thought made her numb with disbelief. She hadn't been Patrick's wife for almost 4.5 years. She'd buried him, right properly, then tried to forget about him as she waited for the money. By the time she received it, he was a fading memory. The only painful moment had come when she sat down with Ashley Nicole to inform the child, then barely 2, that her father would no longer be around, that he had gone on to heaven, where he would certainly be happier. The child was puzzled for a while, then shook it off, as only a toddler can. No one was allowed to mention Patrick's name in the presence of the child. This was to protect her, Trudy had explained. She doesn't remember her father, so please don't try and make her. Other than that one brief episode, she had shouldered the weight of widowhood with remarkable resiliency. She shopped in New Orleans, ordered health foods from California, sweated 2 hours a day in designer spandex, and treated herself to expensive facials and treatments. She had a nanny to keep the kids so she and Lance could travel. They loved the Caribbean, especially St. Bart's with its nude beaches. They stripped and strutted with the French. Christmas was in New York at the Plaza. January was in Vail with the rich and beautiful. May meant Paris and Vienna. They longed for a private jet, like some of the wonderful people they'd met in the fast lane. A small, used Lear could be bought for $1 million, but for now was out of the question. Lance claimed to be working on this idea, and she worried any time he grew serious about business matters. She knew he smuggled dope, but it was just pot and hash from Mexico, and there was little risk. They needed the income, and she liked him out of the house occasionally. She didn't hate Patrick. Not the dead one, anyway. She just hated the fact that he wasn't dead, that he had been resurrected and was back to complicate things. She'd first met him at a party in New Orleans during a period of time when she was pouting with Lance and looking for another husband, preferably one with money and promise. She was 27, 4 years out of a bad marriage, and restless for stability. He was 33, still single, and ready to settle down. He had just accepted a job with a nice firm in Biloxi, which was where she happened to be living at the time. After 4 months of non-stop passion, they were married in Jamaica. 3 weeks after the honeymoon, Lance sneaked into their new apartment and spent the night while Patrick was away on business. She couldn't lose the money. That was for certain. Her lawyer would simply have to do something, find some loophole which would allow her to keep it. That's what he got paid to do. Surely the insurance company couldn't get the house, the furniture and cars and clothes, the bank accounts, the boat, the fabulous thing she'd bought with the money. It just didn't seem fair. Patrick had died. She'd buried him. She'd been a widow now for over 4 years. That must count for something. It wasn't her fault he was alive. "We'll have to kill him, you know," Lance said in the semi-darkness. He had moved to a cushioned chair between the bed and the window, his bare feet draped over an ottoman. She didn't move, didn't flinch in the smallest way, but thought about it for a second before saying, "Don't be stupid." This she offered with little conviction. "There is no alternative, you know that." "We're in enough trouble." She only breathed. Her wrist still stuck to her forehead, eyes closed, perfectly still, and actually quite happy that Lance had broached the subject. She, of course, had thought about this within minutes of being told that Patrick was headed home. She had walked through various scenarios, each leading to the same inescapable conclusion. To keep the money, Patrick must be dead. It was, after all, an insurance policy on his life. She couldn't kill him. That was a ridiculous notion. Lance, on the other hand, had lots of shadowy friends in dark places.
"You want to keep the money, don't you?" he asked.
"I can't think about it now, Lance. Maybe later."
Perhaps real soon. She couldn't seem eager or Lance would get too excited. As usual, she would manipulate him, string him along into some devilish plot until it was too late for him to back out.
"We can't wait too long, baby. Hell, the life insurance company's already got us choked."
"Please, Lance."
"There ain't no way around it. You want to keep this house, the money, everything we've got, then he's got to die."
She didn't speak or move for a long time, but his words delighted her soul. In spite of half a brain and many other flaws, Lance was the only man she'd ever loved. He was nasty enough to take care of Patrick, but was he smart enough not to get caught? The agent's name was Brent Myers from the office in Biloxi, sent by Cutter to make contact with their prize. He introduced himself and flashed a badge at Patrick, who hardly acknowledged it while reaching for the remote. "A pleasure," he said as he pulled the sheets over his boxer shorts. "I'm from the office in Biloxi," Myers said, genuinely trying to be nice. "Where's that?" Patrick asked, poker-faced. "Yes, well, I thought we should meet and get to know each other. We'll be spending some time together during the next few months."
"Don't be so sure of that."
"Do you have a lawyer?"
"Not yet."
"Do you plan to hire one?"
"Absolutely none of your business."
Myers was obviously no match for a seasoned lawyer like Lanigan. He placed his hands on the railing across the foot of the bed and stared at Patrick with his best effort at intimidation.
"Doc says you might be ready to transport in 2 days," he said.
"So? I'm ready now."
"There's quite a party waiting on you in Biloxi."
I've been watching, Patrick said, nodding at the television.
Don't suppose you'd want to answer some questions?
Patrick snorted his contempt at this ludicrous suggestion.
Didn't think so, Myers said, and took a step for the door. Anyway, I'll be escorting you home.
He tossed a card on the sheets.
Here's my hotel number in case you want to talk.
Don't sit by the phone. Chapter 10 Sandy McDermott had read with great interest the news accounts of the amazing discovery of his old pal from law school. He and Patrick had studied and partied together for 3 years at Tulane. They had clerked for the same judge after they passed the bar exam, and they had spent many hours in their favorite pub on St. Charles plotting their assault upon the legal world. They would build a firm together, a small but powerful firm of hard-charging trial lawyers with impeccable ethics. They would get rich in the process, and they would donate 10 hours a month to clients who couldn't afford to pay. It was all planned. Life intervened. Sandy took a job as an assistant federal prosecutor, primarily because the pay was good and he was a newlywed. Patrick got lost in a firm with 200 lawyers in downtown New Orleans. Marriage eluded him because he worked 80 hours a week. Their plans for their perfect little firm lasted until they were about 30. They tried to meet for a quick lunch or a drink whenever possible, though the meetings and the phone calls happened less frequently as the years passed. Then Patrick escaped to a calmer life in Biloxi, and they hardly spoke once a year. Sandy's big break in the suing game came when the friend of a cousin was maimed on an offshore oil rig in the Gulf. He borrowed $10,000, opened his own shop, sued Exxon, and collected close to $3 million, one-third of which he kept. He was in business. Without Patrick, he built a nice little firm of 3 lawyers whose specialty was offshore injuries and deaths. When Patrick died, Sandy actually sat down with his calendar and determined that it had been 9 months since he talked to his buddy. Of course, he felt lousy about this, but he was also realistic. Like most college friends, they had simply gone their separate ways. He sat with Trudy through the ordeal, and he helped carry the casket to the grave. When the money disappeared 6 weeks later and the gossip started, Sandy had laughed to himself and wished his buddy well. Run, Patrick, run, he'd thought many times over the past 4 years, and always with a smile. Sandy's office was off Poydras Street, 9 blocks from the Superdome, near the intersection of Magazine, in a beautiful 19th-century building he'd bought with an offshore settlement. He leased the second and third floors and kept the bottom one for himself, his 2 partners, 3 paralegals, and 6 secretaries. He was very busy when his secretary entered his office with a grim face and said, "There's a lady here to see you." "Does she have an appointment?" he asked, glancing at one of 3 daily, weekly, monthly planners on the edge of his desk.
"No. She says it's urgent. She's not leaving. It's about Patrick Lanigan."
He looked at her curiously.
"She says she's a lawyer,"
the secretary said. "Where's she from?"
"Brazil."
"Brazil?"
"Yes."
"Does she look, you know, Brazilian?"
"I guess." "Show her in."
Sandy met her at the door and greeted her warmly. Eva gave her name as Leia, with nothing behind it.
"I didn't catch your last name," Sandy said, all smiles.
"I don't use one," she said. "Not yet, anyway."
Must be a Brazilian thing, Sandy thought, like Pele, the soccer player, just a first name with no last. He escorted her to a chair in the corner and sent for coffee. She declined and sat slowly. He glanced at her legs. She was dressed casually, nothing flashy. He sat across the coffee table from her and noticed her eyes. Beautiful eyes, light brown, but very tired. Her long, dark hair fell past her shoulders. Patrick always had a good eye. Trudy was a mismatch, but she could certainly stop traffic.
"I'm here on behalf of Patrick," she said haltingly.
"Did he send you?" Sandy asked.
"Yes, he did."
She spoke slowly, her words soft and low. The accent was very slight.
"Did you study in the States?" he asked.
Yes, I have a degree in law from Georgetown.
That would explain the near-perfect American English. And you practice where?
In a firm in Rio. My work is in international trade.
She had yet to smile, and this bothered Sandy. A visitor from afar, a beautiful one at that, one with a brain and nice legs. He wanted her to relax in the warmth of his office. This was, after all, New Orleans.
Is that where you met Patrick?
He asked.
Yes, in Rio.
Have you spoken to him since?
No, not since he was taken.
She almost added that she was desperately worried about him, but that would seem unprofessional. She was not to divulge much here, nothing about her relationship with Patrick. Sandy McDermott could be trusted, but he was to be fed information in small doses. There was a pause as they both looked away, and Sandy instinctively knew that there were many chapters to this story he would never know. But oh, the questions. How did he steal the money? How did he get to Brazil? How did he pick her up along the way? And the big one. Where's the money?
So what am I supposed to do?
He asked.
I want to retain you for Patrick.
I'm available.
Confidentiality is crucial.
It always is.
This is different.
Got that right, different to the tune of $90 million. I assure you that anything you and Patrick tell me will be held in the strictest of confidence, he said with a reassuring smile, and she managed a very slight one in return.
You might be pressured to divulge client secrets, she said.
I'm not worried about that. I can take care of myself.
You might be threatened.
I've been threatened before.
You might be followed.
By whom?
Some very nasty people.
Who?
The people chasing Patrick.
I think they've caught him.
Yes, but not the money.
I see. So the money was still around. That was not surprising. Sandy, and everyone else for that matter, knew Patrick couldn't go through such a fortune in 4 years. But how much was left?
Where is the money?
He asked, somewhat tentatively, not for a moment expecting an answer.
You can't ask that question.
I just did. Leia smiled and quickly moved on.
Let's settle some details. How much is your retainer?
For what am I being retained?
To represent Patrick.
For which batch of sins? According to the newspapers, it'll take an entire army of lawyers to cover his flanks.
$100,000?
That'll do for starters. Am I doing the civil as well as the criminal?
Everything.
Just me?
Yes. He wants no other lawyer.
I'm touched, Sandy said, and he meant it. There were dozens of lawyers Patrick could turn to now, bigger lawyers with more death penalty experience, connected lawyers on the coast with local clout, lawyers in bigger firms with more resources, and, undoubtedly, lawyers who'd been closer friends than Sandy had been for the past 8 years.
Then I'm hired, he said.
Patrick's an old friend, you know.
I know.
How much did she really know, he wondered. Was she more than a lawyer?
I'd like to wire the money today, she said, if you could give me wiring instructions.
Of course. I'll prepare a contract for legal services.
There are some other things Patrick is concerned about. One is publicity. He wants you to say nothing to the press. Never. Not a word. No press conferences. Not even a casual no comment.
No problem.
You can't write a book about it when it's over.
Sandy actually laughed, but she missed the humor.
I wouldn't think of it, he said.
He wants it in the contract.
He stopped laughing and scribbled something to that effect on the legal pad.
Anything else?
Yes, you can expect your office and home to get wired. You should hire a surveillance expert to protect you. Patrick is willing to pay for this.
Done.
And it will be best if we don't meet here again. There are people trying to find me because they think I can lead them to the money. So we'll meet in other places.
There was nothing Sandy could say to this. He wanted to help, to offer protection, to question her about where she would go and how she would hide. But Leia seemed to have things very much under control.
She glanced at her watch.
There's a flight to Miami in 3 hours. I have 2 first-class tickets. We can talk on the plane.
Where might I be going?
You'll fly on to San Juan to see Patrick. I've made arrangements.
And you?
I'll go another direction.
Sandy ordered more coffee and muffins while they waited for the wiring instructions to be finalized. His secretary canceled his appointments and court appearances for the next 3 days. His wife brought an overnight bag to the office. A paralegal drove them to the airport, and at some point along the way, Sandy noticed she had no luggage, nothing but a small brown leather satchel, well used and quite handsome.
"Where are you staying?" he asked as they sipped a cola in an airport deli.
"Here and there," she said, looking out the window.
"How do I contact you?" he asked.
"We'll work that out later."
They sat next to each other in the third row in first class, and for 20 minutes after takeoff she said nothing as she skimmed a fashion magazine and he tried to read a thick deposition. Sandy didn't want to read the deposition. It could wait. He wanted to talk, to fire away the endless questions, the same questions everyone else wanted to ask. But there was a wall between them, a rather thick one that went far beyond gender and familiarity. She had the answers, but she was perfectly willing to keep them to herself. He tried his best to match her coolness. Salted peanuts and pretzels were distributed. They declined the complimentary champagne. Bottled water was poured.
"So how long have you known Patrick?" he asked cautiously.
"Why do you ask?"
"Sorry. Look, is there anything you can tell me about what's happened to Patrick in the past 4 years? I am, after all, an old friend, and now I'm his lawyer. You can't blame me for being curious."
"You'll have to ask him," she said with a trace of sweetness, then returned to her magazine. He ate her peanuts.
She waited until they started their descent into Miami before speaking again. It came fast, clearly well rehearsed.
"I won't see you again for a few days. I have to keep moving because of the people after me. Patrick will give you instructions, and for the time being he and I will communicate through you. Watch for the unusual, a stranger on the phone, a car behind you, someone hanging around your office. Once you're identified as his lawyer, you will attract the people who are looking for me."
"Who are they?"
"Patrick will tell you."
"You have the money, don't you?"
"I can't answer that question."
He watched the clouds get closer below the wing. Of course the money had grown. Patrick wasn't an idiot. He'd stashed it away in a foreign bank where pros handled it. Probably earned at least 12% a year. There was no more conversation until they landed. They hurried through the terminal to catch his flight to San Juan. She shook his hand firmly and said,
"Tell Patrick I'm fine."
"He'll ask where you are."
"Europe."
He watched her disappear into the mass of hustling travelers, and as he did, he envied his old friend. All that money. A gorgeous lady with exotic charm and class. A boarding call woke him up. He shook his head and asked himself how he could envy a man who now faced the possibility of spending the next 10 years on death row waiting to be executed, and 100 hungry lawyers anxious to peel away his skin in search of the money. Envy. He took his seat, first class again, and began to feel the magnitude of representing Patrick. Eva took a cab back to the trendy hotel on South Beach where she had spent the night. She would be there for a few days, depending on what happened in Biloxi. Patrick had told her to move around and not to stay in one place more than 4 days. She was registered under the name of Lea Pirish and now had a gold credit card issued to her in that name. Her address was in Sao Paulo. She quickly changed and went to the beach. It was mid-afternoon, the beach was crowded, and that suited her fine. Her beaches in Rio were crowded, but there were always friends around. Now she was a stranger. Another nameless beauty in a small bikini baking in the sun. She wanted to go home. Chapter 11. It took Sandy an hour to bully his way through the outer walls of the Navy base. His new client had not made things easy. No one seemed to know he was expected. He was forced to rely upon the attorney's usual repertoire, threats of instantaneous lawsuits, threats of ominous phone calls to senators and others in high places, and loud and angry complaints of all sorts of rights violations. He made it to the hospital office at dark and hit another line of defense. But this time a nurse simply called Patrick. His room was dark, lit only by the bluish light of the muted television hanging high in a corner, a soccer game from Brazil. The two old pals shook hands gently. They had not seen each other in 6 years. Patrick kept a sheet pulled to his chin, hiding his wounds. For the moment, the soccer game seemed more important than serious conversation. If Sandy was hoping for a warm reunion, he quickly adjusted to a subdued one. While trying not to stare, he studied Patrick's face. It was thin, almost gaunt, with a newly squared chin and a sharper nose. He could pass for someone else but for the eyes, and the voice was unmistakable. "Thanks for coming," Patrick said. All of his words were very soft, as if the act of speaking required great effort and thought. "Sure. Didn't have much of a choice, you know. Your friend is very persuasive." Patrick closed his eyes and bit his tongue. He said a quick prayer of thanks. She was out there and she was fine. "How much did she pay you?" he asked.
$100,000.
"Good," Patrick said, and then said no more. A long pause, and Sandy slowly realized that their conversations would be built around long, silent intervals.
"She's fine," he said. "She's a beautiful woman. She's smart as hell and fully in control of whatever she's supposed to be in control of, in case you're wondering."
"That's nice.
When was the last time you saw her?"
"A couple of weeks. I've lost track of time."
"Is she the wife, girlfriend, mistress, hooker,
lawyer?"
"Lawyer?"
"Yes, lawyer." Sandy was amused by this. Patrick shut down again, no words, no movement anywhere under the sheet. Minutes passed. Sandy took a seat in the only chair, content to wait for his friend. Patrick was re-entering an ugly world where the wolves were waiting, and if he wanted to lie there and stare at the ceiling, then that was fine with Sandy. They would have lots of time to talk, and no shortage of topics. He was alive, and right now nothing else mattered. Sandy amused himself by recalling images of the funeral and burial, of the casket being lowered on a cold and cloudy day, of the priest's last words and Trudy's controlled sobs. It was downright funny to think that old Patrick had been hiding in a tree not far away, watching them grieve, as had been reported for 3 days now. He laid low somehow, then snatched the money. Some men crack up when they near 40. The midlife crisis drives them to a new wife or back to college. Not old Patrick. He celebrated his angst by killing himself, stealing $90 million, and disappearing. The real dead body in the car suddenly erased the humor, and Sandy wanted to talk.
"There's quite a welcome committee back home, Patrick," he said.
"Who's the chairman?"
"Hard to say. Trudy filed for divorce 2 days ago, but that's the least of your problems."
"You're right about that.
Let me guess, she wants half of the money."
"She wants many things."
"The grand jury has indicted you for capital murder. State, not federal."
"I've watched it on television."
"Good. So you know about all the lawsuits?"
"Yeah. CNN has been quite diligent in keeping me up to date."
"You can't blame him, Patrick. It's such a wonderful story."
"Thanks."
"When do you want to talk?"
Patrick rolled to his side and gazed past Sandy.
There was nothing to look at but the wall, painted antiseptic white, but he wasn't looking at it.
"They tortured me, Sandy," he said, his voice even quieter and breaking.
"Who?"
"They taped wires to my body and shot current through me until I talked."
Sandy stood and walked to the edge of the bed.
He placed his hand on Patrick's shoulder.
What did you tell them?
I don't know. I can't remember everything. They were shooting drugs in me. Here, look.
He lifted his left arm so Sandy could inspect the bruises. Sandy found a switch and flipped on the table lamp so he could see.
Good Lord, he said. They kept on about the money, Patrick said. I blacked out, then I came to and they shocked me some more. I'm afraid I told them about the girl, Sandy.
The lawyer?
Yeah, the lawyer. What name did she give you?
Leia.
Okay, good. Her name is Leia, then. I might have told them about Leia. In fact, I'm almost certain I did.
Told who, Patrick?
He closed his eyes and grimaced as the pain returned to his legs. The muscles were still raw, and the cramping had begun. He gently rolled again and rested on his back. He pulled the sheet down to his waist. Look, Sandy, he said, waving his hand across the two nasty burns on his chest. Here's the proof.
Sandy leaned a bit closer and inspected the evidence, the red sores surrounded by shaved skin.
Who did this? He asked again. I don't know. A bunch of people. There was a whole room full of them.
Where?
Patrick felt sorry for his friend. He was so eager to know what had happened, and not just about the torture.
Sandy, as well as the rest of the world, wanted the irresistible details. It was indeed a wonderful story, but he wasn't sure how much he could tell. No one knew the details of the car crash that burned John Doe, but he could tell his lawyer and friend about his seizure and torture. He shifted his weight again and pulled the sheet up to his neck. Drug-free for 2 days now, he was coping with the pain and trying mightily to avoid more injections.
Pull that chair closer and take a seat, Sandy, and turn off that switch. The light bothers me.
Sandy hurriedly followed orders. He sat as close to the bed as possible.
This is what they did to me, Sandy, Patrick said in the semi-darkness.
He started in Pontoporan, with the jogging and the small car with a flat tire, and told the entire story of how they grabbed him. Ashley Nicole was 25 months old when her father was buried. She was too young to remember Patrick. Lance was the only man who lived in the house, the only man she'd ever seen with her mom. He took her to school occasionally. They sometimes ate dinner as a family. After the funeral, Trudy hid all photos and other evidence of her life with Patrick. Ashley Nicole had never heard his name mentioned. But after 3 days of reporters camping on their street, the child naturally was asking questions. Her mother was acting strange. There was so much tension around the house that even a 6-year-old could feel it. Trudy waited until Lance left for a visit with the lawyer, then she sat her daughter on her bed for a little chat. She began by admitting that she had been married before. Actually, she'd been married twice before, but she figured Ashley Nicole wouldn't need to know about the first husband until she was much older. The second husband was the issue for the moment.
Patrick and I were married for 4 years, and then he did a very bad thing.
What? Ashley Nicole asked, wide-eyed and absorbing more than Trudy wanted.
He killed a man, and he made it look like... Well, there was a big car wreck, you see, a big fire, and it was Patrick's car, and the police found a body inside the car once the fire was out, and the police figured it was Patrick. Everybody did. Patrick was gone, burned up in his car, and I was very sad. He was my husband. I loved him dearly, and he was suddenly gone. We buried him in the cemetery. Now, 4 years later, they found Patrick off hiding on the other side of the world. He ran away and hid.
Why?
Because he stole a bunch of money from his friends, and since he's a very bad man, he wanted to keep all of this money for himself.
He killed a man and he stole money.
That's right, honey. Patrick is not a nice person.
I'm sorry you were married to him, Mommy.
Yes. But, look, honey, there's something you need to understand. You were born when Patrick and I were married.
She let the words drift through the air and watched the little eyes to see if she caught the message. Evidently not. She squeezed Ashley Nicole's hand and said,
"Patrick is your father."
She looked blankly at her mother, the wheels turning rapidly in her head.
"But I don't want him to be." "I'm sorry, honey. I was going to tell you when you were much older, but Patrick is about to come back now, and it's important for you to know." "What about Lance? Isn't he my father?"
"No. Lance and I are just together, that's all." Trudy had never allowed her to refer to Lance as her father, and Lance, for his part, had never shown the slightest interest in approaching the arena of fatherhood. Trudy was a single mom. Ashley Nicole had no father. This was perfectly common and acceptable. "Lance and I have been friends for a long time," Trudy said, keeping the initiative and trying to prevent a thousand questions. "Very close friends. He loves you very much, but he is not your father. Not your real father, anyway. Patrick, I'm afraid, is your real father, but I don't want you to worry about him."
"Does he want to see me?"
"I don't know, but I'll fight forever to keep him away from you. He is a very bad person, honey. He left you when you were 2 years old. He left me. He stole a bunch of money and disappeared. He didn't care about us then, and he doesn't care about us now. He wouldn't be coming back if they hadn't caught him. We would never have seen him again, so don't worry about Patrick and what he might do." Ashley Nicole crawled across the end of the bed and cuddled in her mother's lap. Trudy squeezed and patted her.
"It's going to be all right, honey. I promise. I hated to tell you this, but with all those reporters out there and all the stuff on television, well, I just thought it best." "Why are those people out there?"
she asked, clutching her mother's arms.
"I don't know. I wish they would leave." "What do they want?" "Pictures of you. Pictures of me. Pictures they can put in the newspapers when they talk about Patrick and all the bad things he's done." "So they're out there because of Patrick?" "Yes, honey."
She turned and looked at Trudy square in the eyes and said,
"I hate Patrick."
Trudy shook her head as if the child were naughty. Then she clutched her tightly and smiled. Lance was born and raised on Point Cadet, an old fishing community on a small peninsula jutting into the Bay of Biloxi. The point was a working neighborhood where the immigrants landed and the shrimpers lived. He grew up in the streets on the point, and still had many friends there, one of whom was Cap. It was Cap who had been behind the wheel of the van loaded with marijuana when the narcs stopped them. They had awakened Lance, who had been asleep with his shotgun amid the thick blocks of cannabis. Cap and Lance had used the same lawyer, received the same sentence, and at 19 been sent away together. Cap ran a pub and loan-sharked money to cannery workers. Lance met him for a drink in the rear of the pub, something they tried to do at least once a month, though Cap saw less and less of Lance now that Trudy had become wealthy and they had moved to Mobile. His friend was troubled. Cap had read the papers, had in fact been waiting for Lance to appear with a long face, looking for a sympathetic ear. They caught up on the gossip over beer. Who had won how much at the casinos, where the newest crack source was, who was being shadowed by the DEA, the usual idle chit-chat of small-time coast crooks still dreaming of riches. Cap despised Trudy, and in the past he had often laughed at Lance for trailing behind her wherever she might go.
"So how's the whore?" he asked. "She's fine. Worried, you know, since they've caught him." "She ought to be worried. How much life insurance did she collect?"
"Couple of mil."
"Paper said 2.5. Way that bitch spends it, though, I'm sure there ain't much left."
"It's safe."
"Safe my ass. Paper said she's already been sued by the life insurance company."
"We got lawyers, too."
"Yeah, but you ain't here 'cause you got lawyers, Lance, are you? You're here 'cause you need help. Lawyers can't do what she needs."
Lance smiled and sipped his beer. He lit a cigarette, something he could never do around Trudy.
"Where's Zeke?"
"That's exactly what I figured,"
Cap said angrily. She gets in trouble, her money is threatened, and so she sends you down here looking for Zeke or some other clutch he can grease to do something stupid. He gets caught, you get caught, you take the fall, and she forgets your name. You're a dumbass, Lance, you know that?
Yeah, I know. Where's Zeke?
In jail.
Where?
Texas. Feds got him running guns. You're stupid, you know that? Don't do this. When they bring your guy back, there'll be cops crawling all around him. They'll lock him away someplace. His mother can't even get near him. There's serious money at stake here, Lance. They gotta protect this guy until he breaks and tells where he's buried it, you know? You try to hit him and you'll kill half a dozen cops and die trying.
Not if it's done right.
And I suppose you know how to do it. Could that be because you ain't ever done it before? When did you get so damn smart?
I can find the right people.
For how much?
Whatever it takes.
You got 50 grand?
Yeah.
Cap took a deep breath and glanced around his pub. Then he leaned forward on his elbows and glared at his friend.
Let me tell you why it's a bad idea, Lance. You never were too bright, you know. Girls always liked you because they think you're cute, but thinking was never your strong suit.
Thanks, pal.
Everybody wants this guy alive. Think about it. Everybody. Feds, the lawyers, the cops, the guy whose money got stolen, everybody. Except, of course, that flea bag who lets you live in her house. She needs him dead. If you pull this and somehow knock him off, the cops go straight to her. She, of course, will be completely innocent because you'll be there to take the fall. That's what little stud puppies are for. He's dead, she keeps the money, which you and I know is the only thing that matters to her, and you go back to Parchman because you got a record, remember? For the rest of your life, she won't even write you.
Can we get it done for 50?
We?
Yeah, me and you.
I can give you a name. That's all. I'm not touching this. It won't work, and there's nothing in it for me.
Who is it?
A guy from New Orleans. He hangs around here some.
Can you make the call?
Yeah, but that's it. And remember, I told you not to mess with this.
Chapter 12 Eva left Miami on a flight to New York, where she boarded the Concorde and flew to Paris. The Concorde was an extravagance, but she now considered herself to be a wealthy woman. From Paris to Nice, and from there across the countryside by car to Aix-en-Provence, a journey she and Patrick had made almost 1 year earlier. It was the only time he'd left Brazil since he'd arrived. He was terrified of crossing borders, even with a perfect new phony passport. Brazilians love all things French, and virtually all with education know the language and culture. They had taken a suite at the Via Galicki, a beautiful inn on the edge of town, and spent a week strolling the streets, shopping, eating, and occasionally venturing into the villages between Aix and Avignon. They also spent a lot of time in their room, like newlyweds. Once, after too much wine, Patrick referred to it as their honeymoon. She found a smaller room at the same hotel, and after a nap had tea on the patio in her bathrobe. Later she dressed in jeans and took a casual walk into town, to the Cour Mirabeau, the main avenue of Aix. She sipped a glass of red wine at a crowded sidewalk cafe and watched the college kids parade back and forth. She envied the young lovers strolling aimlessly, hand in hand, nothing to worry about. She and Patrick had made these walks, arm in arm, whispering and laughing, as if the shadows behind him had vanished. It was in Aix, during the only week they had ever spent together without interruption, that she first realized how little he slept. Regardless of when she awoke, he was already awake, lying still and quiet, and staring at her as if she were in danger. A table lamp was on. The room would be dark when she fell asleep, but a light would be on when she awoke. He would turn it off, rub her gently until she fell asleep, then sleep himself for half an hour before turning the light on again. He was up well before dawn, and usually had read the newspapers and several chapters of a mystery by the time she ambled forth and found him on the patio. "Never more than 2 hours," he answered when she asked how long he could sleep. He seldom napped and never went to bed early. He didn't carry a weapon or peek around corners. He wasn't overly suspicious of strangers, and he seldom talked about life on the run. Except for his sleeping habits, he seemed so perfectly normal that she often forgot he was one of the most wanted men in the world. Though he preferred not to talk about his past, there were times in their conversations when it became unavoidable. They were together, after all, only because he had fled and recreated himself. His favorite topic was his boyhood in New Orleans, not the adult life he was running from. He almost never mentioned his wife, but Eva knew she was a person Patrick deeply despised. It had become a miserable marriage, and as it deteriorated, he became determined to flee it. He had tried to talk about Ashley Nicole, but the thought of the child brought tears to his eyes. His voice quit him, and he said he was sorry. It was too painful. Because the past was not yet complete, the future was difficult to contemplate. Plans were impossible as long as shadows were moving back there somewhere. He would not allow himself to speculate on the future until the past was settled. The shadows kept him awake. She knew that. Shadows he couldn't see. Shadows only he could feel. They had met in her office in Rio 2 years earlier when he presented himself as a Canadian businessman who now lived in Brazil. He said he needed a good lawyer to advise him on import and taxation matters. He was dressed for the part in a handsome linen suit with a white starched shirt. He was lean and tanned and friendly. His Portuguese was very good, though not as good as her English. He wanted to speak in her language. She insisted on his. They had a business lunch that lasted 3 hours, with the languages switching back and forth, and both realized there would be others. Then there was a long dinner and a barefoot walk on the beach at Ipanema. Her husband was an older man who'd been killed in a plane crash in Chile. No children. Patrick, or Danilo, as he was at first called, claimed to be happily divorced from his first wife, who still lived in Toronto, their home. Eva and Danilo saw each other several times a week during the first 2 months as the romance flourished. Finally, he told the truth. All of it. After a late dinner in her apartment and a bottle of good French wine, Danilo confronted his past and bared his soul. He talked non-stop until the early hours of the morning and went from a confident businessman to a frightened man on the run. Frightened and anxious, but extremely wealthy. The relief was so forceful he almost cried, but caught himself. This was, after all, Brazil, and men simply did not cry, especially in front of beautiful women. She loved him for it. She embraced him and kissed him and cried when he couldn't and promised to do everything in her power to hide him. He had given her his darkest, deadliest secret, and she promised to always protect it. During the next weeks, he told her where the money was and taught her how to move it quickly around the world. Together they studied offshore tax havens and found safe investments. He had been in Brazil 2 years by the time they met. He had lived in Sao Paulo, his first home there, and Recife, and Minas Gerais, and half a dozen other places. He had spent 2 months working on the Amazon, sleeping on a floating barge under a thick mosquito net, the insects so thick he couldn't see the moon. He had cleaned wild game killed by rich Argentines in the Pantanal, a mammoth preserve the size of Great Britain in the states of Mato Grosso and Mato Grosso do Sul. He had seen more of her country than she. He'd been to places she'd never heard of. He had carefully selected Ponta Porã as his home. It was small and remote, and in a land of a million perfect hiding places, Danilo decided Ponta Porã was the safest. Plus, it had the tactical advantage of being on the Paraguayan border, an easy place to run to if a threat occurred. She didn't argue with this. She preferred that he stay in Rio, close to her, but she knew nothing about life on the run, and she reluctantly deferred to his judgment. He promised many times that they would be together someday. They occasionally met at the apartment in Curitiba, brief little honeymoons that never lasted much more than a few days. She longed for more, but he was unwilling to make plans. As the months passed, Danilo, she never called him Patrick, became more convinced that he would be found. She refused to believe this, especially given the meticulous steps he took to avoid his past. He worried more, slept even less, talked more about what she should do in this scenario or that one. He stopped talking about the money. His premonitions were haunting him. She would stay in X for a few days, watching CNN International and reading what she could find in American newspapers. They would move Patrick shortly, take him home and put him in jail and file all sorts of hideous charges against him. He knew he would be locked up, but he'd assured her he would be fine. He would cope. He could handle anything as long as she promised to wait for him. She'd probably return to Zurich and tidy up her affairs. Beyond that, she wasn't certain. Home was out of the question, and this weighed heavy on her mind. She had talked to her father 3 times, always calling from airport payphones, always reassuring him she was okay. She just couldn't come home now, she explained. She and Patrick would communicate through Sandy, but weeks would pass before she would actually see him. He called for the first pill just before 2 a.m., after waking with a sharp pain. It felt like the voltage returning to his legs, and the cruel voices of his captors were taunting him. "Where's the money, Patrick?" they chanted like a demonic chorus. "Where's the money?" The pill arrived on a tray carried by a lethargic night orderly who forgot to bring cold water. He demanded a glass, then swallowed the pill and washed it away with warm soda from a leftover can. 10 minutes, and nothing happened. His body was covered with sweat. The sheets were drenched. The sores burned from the salt in the sweat. 10 minutes. He turned on the television. The men who had tied him down and burned him were still out there, looking for the money, no doubt fully aware of where he was at this moment. He felt safer in daylight. Darkness and dreams brought them back. 30 minutes. He called the nurse's station, but no one answered. He drifted away. At 6, he was awake when his doctor entered, smileless today, all business as he poked the wounds quickly, then declared, "You're ready to go. They have good doctors waiting for you where you're going." He scribbled in his chart and left without another word. 30 minutes later, Agent Brent Myers sauntered into the room with a nasty smile and a flash of the badge as if he needed to practice its delivery. "Good morning," he said. Patrick didn't look at him, but said, "Couldn't you knock first?" "Sure. Sorry. Look, Patrick, I just talked to your doc. Great news, man. You're going home. You'll be released tomorrow. I've got orders to bring you back. We'll leave in the morning. Your government is giving you a special flight back to Biloxi on a military plane. Isn't that exciting? And I'll be with you." "Could you leave now?" "Sure. See you early in the morning."
"Just leave." He bounced from the room and closed the door. Luis was next, arriving quietly with a tray of coffee and juice and sliced mangoes. He slid a package under Patrick's mattress and asked if he needed anything else. "No," Patrick said, thanking him softly. An hour later, Sandy arrived for what he thought would be a long day of digging through the past 4 years and finding answers to his countless questions. The television went off, the shades opened, the room brightened up as the day began. "I want you to go home immediately," Patrick said, "and take these with you." He handed over the package. Sandy sat in the only chair, flipping through the photos of his naked friend, taking his time. "When were these taken?" he asked. "Yesterday." Sandy made a note of this on a yellow legal pad. "By whom?" "Luis, the orderly." "Who did this to you?"
"Who has custody of me, Sandy?"
"The FBI."
"So I think the FBI did it to me. My own government tracked me down, caught me, tortured me, and is now hauling me back.
The government, Sandy. The FBI, Justice Department, and the locals, the DA and the rest of my welcoming party. Just look at what they've done to me.
They should be sued for this, Sandy said. For millions. And quickly.
Here's the plan. I'm leaving in the morning on some type of military flight to Biloxi. You can imagine the reception I'll get. We should take advantage of it.
Take advantage?
Exactly. We should file our lawsuit late this afternoon so it'll be in the paper tomorrow. Leak it to the press. Show them two of the photos, the two I've got marked there on the back.
Sandy shuffled until he picked out the photos. One was a close-up of the burns on Patrick's chest, with his face visible. The other showed the third-degree burn on his left thigh.
You want me to give these to the press?
Only to the Coast paper. That's the only one I'm worried about. It's read by 80% of Harrison County, where I'm sure our jury will come from.
Sandy smiled, then chuckled.
You didn't sleep much last night, did you?
I haven't slept in 4 years.
This is brilliant.
No, but it's one of the few tactical advantages we can spring on those hyenas circling my carcass. We broadside them with this and we soften up the sentiment a bit. Think of it, Sandy. The FBI torturing a suspect, an American citizen. Brilliant. Just brilliant. We sue only the FBI?
Yes, keep it simple.
Me versus the FBI, the government, for permanent physical and psychological injury sustained during a brutal torture and interrogation session somewhere in the jungles of Brazil.
Sounds wonderful to me.
It'll sound even better when the press gets finished with it.
How much?
I don't care. $10 million in actual damages, $100 million in punitive.
Sandy scrawled notes and flipped to the next page. Then he stopped and studied Patrick's face.
It wasn't really the FBI, was it?
No, Patrick said, it wasn't.
I was delivered to the FBI by some faceless thugs who've been chasing me for a long time. And they're still lurking out there somewhere.
Does the FBI know about them?
Yes.
The room went silent, as Sandy waited for more and Patrick became tight-lipped. Nurses could be heard prattling in the hallway.
Patrick shifted his weight. 3 days on his back, and he was ready for a change of scenery.
You need to hurry.